Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Undoctrinate Yourself. Today is a special recording from my boot camp class. I interviewed slash had a conversation with Sam Parker, who works at Zorp, which is a blockchain-based company that's doing a lot of really cool things. I'm going to include in the show notes here how to find out about the company and about Sam, where to find him. But we had a conversation about Bitcoin and how to get started with Bitcoin. What is Bitcoin? The very basics about, like, if you're a complete newbie to the space and you want to start getting some coin, aka stacking sats, as Bitcoin maxis would say. He's going to teach you how to do it here. And so I hope you guys enjoy it. Again, head to the show notes for relevant links for Sam, as well as for products and services that we discuss in this episode. I hope you enjoy it. Hello, people. We are in sunny El Salvador. I am accompanied by Sam Parker, who is a self-taught savant genius person who is going to share with us today.
I still don't know quite what I'm supposed to be talking about, but I think it's vaguely Bitcoin centric. But yeah,
Yes.
nice to be here. I am just letting Alexis
Take the reins.
kind of take the reins and tell me what I'm
Yeehaw.
supposed to be talking to you guys about.
Yeehaw. So a lot of people in the class don't know anything about Bitcoin. I basically said just go buy some Bitcoin to get started and we'll get to it eventually, but I'm still learning, so I wanted to bring somebody who's a seasoned veteran in the space on to talk about maybe how you got into Bitcoin, maybe some Bitcoin theory and decentralization in finance, basic recommendations for how to get started in a safe way that's not an ETF.
Yeah.
And maybe d describe the difference between like an ETF and like
Yeah,
better ways to
yeah,
buy
yeah.
Bitcoin.
So, well, I got into Bitcoin the way a lot of Bitcoiners got into Bitcoin, which was by shitcoining. And shitcoining for a bit and getting wrecked shitcoining and realizing that that I was tired of that happening and I wanted something safer. So, I was kind of it looks like where someone in the chat is, Courtney was at where I was thinking I was going to make a quick 10 or 100x on some cheesy little shitcoin, and I was going to get out, and that j basically just doesn't happen. I really got into Bitcoin because, like, finances. I think finances. Just thinking about finances stresses me out, and I think it stresses most people out. And what's so great about Bitcoin is once you are kind of on the Bitcoin standard, you stop worrying about your financial situation. You stop thinking about finances entirely. And there's a few reasons why that's the case. The first reason is obviously like the benefit of Bitcoin is that it is self-sovereign. The reason why Bitcoin was invented was it was a way of having a digital monetary system that was self-sovereign. And when we say self-sovereign, we mean that your money, your financial activity cannot be censored. So if you want to send some money to someone else, no one in the world can stop that from happening. Someone wants to send some money to you, no one in the world can stop that from happening. Nobody can confiscate your money. You can't be debanked from Bitcoin because you posted the wrong type of meme on Twitter or something. And most importantly, no entity can inflate your money. And one of the big things that I think lead people into Bitcoin is the understanding that inflation actually is a kind of theft, right? If you print a bunch of money and give it to some small group of people, which is what happens, it is the same as though you were stealing a proportional amount of value, not necessarily in terms of currency, but in terms of value from everyone else that's holding that money, and you're giving it to those people.
Like
So,
taxation without representation.
yeah. And so, really, like the inflation thing, you can kind of think of it as falling under the unconfiscatable nature of it, because really, like the thing that makes inflation bad is it really is a form of theft. But
So you can't print more Bitcoin is the point. There's a fixed amount.
there is only ever going to be 21 million Bitcoin. And just, I'm not going to get really deep into the technology of like how Bitcoin works, but essentially the way your money works right now in a bank is, you know, there's nothing really physical going on there. It's a ledger. And what is a ledger? It's just a list of accounts. And on the left side, it's like, you can make it in Excel, literally. And it's like on the left column, it's the name or some kind of identifier for the person. And on the right, it's a number. And that number is how much money you have. And what it means to spend money from this person to this person is to minus some amount from this number and add the same amount to this other number. And that's how all money has worked ever since that, you know, we've started digitizing our money. And that's how your bank works. And that's basically how Bitcoin works. The only difference is that like the technological innovations in Bitcoin were made to allow for a ledger of that type to work the way that you expect it without there needing to be a central administrator for it. So there's no centralized party that has to authorize me minusing my number and adding to your number. And it just kind of, it happens just kind of by itself. I'm not gonna, this is the wrong setting, I think, to get more in depth as to how that works. But if you're kind of afraid of the technical, Bitcoin can be very kind of like technically daunting, but I think if you just think of it as the same technology as what makes your money work in a bank, just tweaked with a variety of technical innovations to make it not require a bank to actually manage it. And everyone kind of manages their own money. So that's the one element to like why getting on the Bitcoin standard just means you stop spending so much of your very finite time on this earth worried about your finances and thinking about finances, because, you know, you're not worried that your money is going to go away. You're not worried that your money is going to be taken away. You know, I'm from Canada. I think we have another person on the call that's also from Canada. And you might have seen in the news that big trucker protest that that happened during the COVID lockdowns. And you may or may not know, but basically anyone who was associated with that protest, they were debanked. As in, like, they literally couldn't have access to their money. Their credit cards all got revoked. So this is the kind of power that Bitcoin gives you, which, of course, you know, the Canadian Bitcoiners were very quick to help these people get on the Bitcoin standard for saying the Bitcoin. I don't know if you guys have had a chance to see the most recent Joe Rogan podcast with Mark Andreessen, but one of the most interesting things about that was how Mark, who's a big like internet venture capitalist guy, how he was getting into how much of this kind of thing has been going on in the States for, you know, like any like cannabis companies, anyone that are like have any kind of fintech company that's competing in any way with like the centralized banking system, or, you know, just like quote unquote right wing or like quote unquote conspiracy theorist like companies, they're just getting their, you know, they're getting depersoned by getting their losing access to their financials. So this is the kind of like protection against any kind of thing of that nature that Bitcoin gives you, and it helps you sleep better at night. So that's kind of like the self-sovereign nature of Bitcoin. The other side of Bitcoin that makes it such a nice kind of pleasant economic lifestyle, because Bitcoin, if you follow to a stream, it does become a lifestyle, right? It is a cult. And this is actually how I met Jack Cruz. That's where we're at right now. Was I met Jack through the Bitcoin world and slowly became somewhat of a believer in his health stuff. Maybe we can talk about that later. But the other part about why Bitcoin is such a nice financial lifestyle to kind of be a part of is just the economics of it and the quote unquote number go up technology of Bitcoin. And this is the part that every single Bitcoin cycle we get in, I meet with the same kind of questions and concerns, debanking people. Yes, Yvette made an angry face. Absolutely. It seems as though no matter what part in Bitcoin's cycles we are at, newcomers or people, no coiners as we like to call them, have concerns that, oh, I'm too late. I'm too late to Bitcoin. You know, it's gone up and to the right forever, and somehow, like, you know, I'm too late, and it's gonna, all of us right now, it's going to stop going up into the right forever, and it's going to go down, or it's going to stay flat now, and it's just kind of done growing. That is not the case, and is likely to not be the case, possibly within any of our lifetimes. And there's a few reasons for that. One, and the most important reason why that is that Bitcoin has an ultimate scarcity. There can only be 21 million Bitcoin. And by the way, I should also, there's another thing that I think is a hang-up for people when we call this unit bias, which is, oh, I can't afford one Bitcoin, right? It's what is it? It's almost $100,000 now. You do not need to own a whole Bitcoin any more than you need to own a giant bullion of gold to own gold. You can buy a little gold coin, a little sub piece of gold. And it's the same with Bitcoin. The smallest unit of Bitcoin that is ownable is called the Satoshi. As of right now, I believe it's a tenth of a penny. So you can, it doesn't matter who you are, you can own Bitcoin. But yeah, so the reason why, like, the number go up for Bitcoin is going to remain going up is primarily due to its ultimate scarcity. And it's a very, it takes a while to kind of wrap your head around what it means for a money to have an absolute scarcity, and there can only be this amount of it. And what it means for that money to kind of become the global standard for money, which we can get into a little bit, like why that is becoming progressively and more likely to actually be happening. And what a money with an ultimate scarcity being used as the global standard for money starts to look like is kind of less like what we would think of as a currency, and it's more like owning a share in the world, right? If Bitcoin is like the money of everything, owning it makes more sense to not think about how many Satoshis or how many Bitcoin you own, but to think about what percentage of all the Bitcoin you own, of all the Bitcoin that can exist, do you own? And then extrapolating that to like all of human value. And so it's like owning Bitcoin is like owning shares in all of human value production. And that sounds kind of crazy. And maybe it is. Part of like the whole Bitcoin cult is it is this kind of weird like economic sci-fi LARP that we've all been playing for, you know, over two decades now. But the weird thing is it just keeps becoming more and more into reality. It doesn't look as though that's going to stop. And it looks as though this is actually the sci-fi reality that we live in is actually the ones that the Bitcoins have been LARPing about from day one. So that really is like what you should think about when you're thinking about like, you know, oh, am I too early? Am I, is this the right price? You know, is Bitcoin underpriced? Is it overpriced? You need to think of it in terms of like, what percentage of the total supply do you own? And as of very recently, yeah. So, to put it in perspective, if you were to evenly divide all of Bitcoin amongst every person in the world, okay, the amount of USD that amount of Bitcoin would cost is $270. Okay. If you were to not distribute it evenly, because no currency, nothing in the world is ever distributed evenly. If you were instead to distribute Bitcoin to all people following, you know, more of a Pareto sloped distribution, the amount of Bitcoin that the average person has will cost you $50 today. So what that means is if Bitcoin becomes the global standard of value, that we will get into some arguments for why it's looking like that's going to be the case in a minute, then every $50 you spend today is buying you the average net worth of a human being. So you're not early, or you are early, you are not late, and you are likely to not be late while you are still alive. Because this is the thing, is that, you know, completely switching the monetary standard from one thing to another is not a fast process. And this is going to be a gradual process, and there are going to be ups and downs, and there have been ups and downs. We're in the middle of kind of an up period right now. Part of becoming a seasoned Bitcoiner is taking the ups and the downs and not getting too freaked out. And part of what it means to manage the ups and downs is, and now we're getting into like buying strategies, is kind of the gold standard strategy for actually getting into Bitcoin, particularly as a noob. And I just went through this exact same thing with my dad, who, even though he's my father and I've been a big Bitcoiner for almost a decade now, I only orange pilled him like last month. So that's kind of funny, but I went through this exact same thing with him. The golden strategy for getting into Bitcoin is a strategy called DCA, and that stands for dollar cost averaging. And what dollar cost averaging means is that you're like, okay, I want to get into a Bitcoin. You know, let's say you got, let's say you got $100,000 that you would like to allocate to Bitcoin. Generally speaking, it is not great to just jam all of your money into Bitcoin all at the same time. Why? Because Bitcoin, if you average Bitcoin, it's just going up and to the right. But day to day, week to week, even month to month, it's very volatile. And so if you go all in on Bitcoin, you know, you might get lucky and catch it at a low, but you might not get lucky and catch it in a high. And I know plenty of people that, you know, they got FOMO as it's going up, and they, you know, went all in at the top and they were underwater for like two or three years. And now they're fine, but, you know, it kind of feels bad to do that for 2 or 3 years. So the strategy that I definitely recommend for beginners is don't kind of blow your load all at once. What you want to do is you want to buy little bits and spread it out over time. Some people like to do every day. Some people like to do every week. Some people like to do every month. Daily or weekly is, I think, good. But figure out how much you actually want to allocate to Bitcoin, and spread it out over time, little bits every day. And what that does is, as Bitcoin goes up and Bitcoin's going down, you know, sometimes you're going to be buying a little bit at the top, but sometimes you're going to be buying a little bit at the bottom. And what's going to happen is it's going to kind of average out. That's why it's called dollar cost averaging. And it's going to kind of flatten a lot of the volatility that Bitcoin has. And not only is it going to kind of make more sense economically, you're going to feel better emotionally. Like, one of the reason I love Bitcoin so much is it takes all the stress out of financials for me. When you're doing the DCA strategy, you know, you're happy when Bitcoin goes up because the Bitcoin you already have is now worth more. But you're also happy when it goes down because, you know, your next DCA, you're going to get more Bitcoin than you would have otherwise. So it's like you're kind of like emotionally hedged against the volatility of Bitcoin, which is a very good thing. Just generally, like, who the hell likes being stressed about finances? It sucks. So that's definitely my recommendation for like how to actually buy Bitcoin. In general, all of your interactions with Bitcoin, because it is so volatile, I think are best spread out over time. If you want to buy Bitcoin, spread that buy out over time. You want to sell Bitcoin, spread that sell out over time. You want to take a little bit of profits, maybe you want to hedge something, spread that out over time. That's just generally, I think the best way to interact with Bitcoin, to kind of average over its volatility, which can be problematic if you're not used to it. Okay, so we talked about kind of why number go up. Oh, there was one graphic that I wanted to show. I forgot about this. So this was on a, this was actually displayed on a recent conference I went to. I don't know if you guys can see this. Yeah, so you can see this is, so part of like, Alexis, I'm covering your face.
Oh, no, you're fine.
So part of like canon Bitcoin economic theory is the recognition of how much of assets in the world are quote unquote monetized. And what that means is, you know, people want to be able to store their value in something that isn't being deflated. And you can't store that in currency because it's constantly being inflated. So you store your value in other assets, right? You store it in real estate. You store it in bonds, in equities, like in stocks, right? You're not actually using them for anything other than to store your value. And so what that means is that there are these massive premiums on all of these different all of these different asset classes that are at, that are way above what their utility is, right? And these premiums are caused simply by people looking for any place to store their value. And part of like canon Bitcoin economic theory is the recognition that Bitcoin is actually the best just standard store of value that exists because it's so unfuckwithable. I can swear on this, right?
Yes.
Because it's so unfuckwithable, because it has it has ultimate scarcity, and because it is gaining so much adoption. If you just want to store your value and that's your primary concern, you are far better off storing it in Bitcoin than you are in bonds, in equities, in real estates, in art, or whatever. And so if you just look at this little graphic here, you can see all of these different assets. So you see here, you have real estate. I can't even read it. Real estate's 330 trillion. We have bonds, that's 300 trillion. That's money. So like currencies, that's 120 trillion.
You can also send me this picture and I'll include right, it in got my it. Telegram.
Equity is 115 trillion. So, and gold is right up there. That's, what is it? 16 trillion. And right up there, I don't even know you can see it. That tiny little speck. That's 1.8 trillion. That's Bitcoin today. Okay. So as Bitcoin becomes more and more standardized as a store of value, you're going to start to see all of the store of value premium, the monetization of these other assets go flow out of these assets and go into Bitcoin. That's going to do two things simultaneously. One is it's obviously going to make Bitcoin more valuable, which is nice if you're holding Bitcoin, but it's also going to be making all of these other assets way cheaper, right? Real estate's going to become way less expensive because, you know, it's not being used as a piggy bank for people that are just looking to escape from inflation. So yes, once again, you are not late. You are very early. And the more Bitcoin kind of becomes a global standard of value, it's not only going to help people that hold Bitcoin, it's actually going to help everybody. So,
can I add something really quick?
Yes, go ahead.
So Jack often talks about a loyal title as it relates to Bitcoin. I think, I mean, it's maybe slightly related, but not the same as like the sovereignty piece that you mentioned. So can we talk about that a little bit, about what that means?
I don't know what a loyal title
means. So it means that you have ownership of it and it's yours.
Oh yeah, it's like a bearer asset.
Yes. Yeah. So basically I think the way that Jack was talking about this, you can probably educate me on this as well. But when you have, let's say you buy $10 of Bitcoin and then you buy another 50, when it's in a wallet, it's sitting there as like a $10 bill and a $50 bill, even though it says you have a total of $60, yes. But they're not actually, it's not six, it's yes. not 10.
It's not just a big yes. clump.
Yes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I mean, that's kind of getting more into the technicals of it. Like,
okay.
That's more of a pain in the ass than anything. The fact that is the case is that, yes, like these are called UTXOs in Bitcoin land. And yes, every time you receive a discrete amount of Bitcoin, every time you are the recipient of a transaction, it's like you're getting a bill for that amount. So if someone gave you 13.578321 Bitcoin in a transaction, you now have a bill that's worth that much. And if you want to, you know, if I wanted to give Alexis 10 Bitcoin, you know, I would basically split that bill up and give her part and give some of it back to me as change in a new bill. But that, yeah, that's more of just like a pain in the ass. Like that's kind of like it's not a bug, but it just, it's kind of a technicality of using Bitcoin that I think most wallets will actually try to abstract over. So you don't actually need to think about that. Sorry, Michelle is asking, can you talk about self-custody? Yes, I should. But before I get into self-custody, I just wanted to finish the number go up story. So
also two things I want to add when you're done.
Okay. So you may have seen that Trump has the Trump campaign has committed to America getting a strategic reserve of 1 to 2 million Bitcoins. Since Trump has done that, you're seeing a lot of other countries kind of start making noises about similar ideas. And why is that? Well, what the Trump campaign is conceding at this point is that the Bitcoin sci-fi LARP might be true, right? He's not going all in, obviously, the way that El Salvador has. But what's happening is the Trump campaign is conceding the Bitcoin LARP might be true. There is a world in which Bitcoin might become the global standard of value. And in that world, if we, the United States, do not have a shitload of Bitcoin, we are going to be in trouble. We are no longer going to be the global superpower. So we must preserve our hegemony over the world, our financial supremacy over the world. And so we must own all the Bitcoin. And now all the other, because now it's like an arms race. Because now that the states are doing it, now all the other countries are like, okay. Well, if they think that this might be a thing, then, you know, we don't want to get left behind, right? We got to do this. We have to do this as well. And you're seeing kind of like a microcosm version of this also for like a treasury management with companies. Like you may have been following the MicroStrategy thing. And now there's other kind of companies like, oh, well, if MicroStrategy is making all this money by doing nothing other than just buying Bitcoin, you know, maybe we should be doing the same thing too. So it's looking kind of like we're about to get into the kind of the final the buying arms race for Bitcoin that is going to lead to the long prophesized Omega pump. And, you know, we're going to have $1 million green candles in an hour, and Bitcoin is going to go to infinity because no one will be selling Bitcoin. And if they're just by nature of how markets work, if there are, you know, open market buy offers to buy Bitcoin and no one is selling, then the price is technically infinity. Or conversely, the price of US dollar has dropped to zero. One or the other, they're the same thing. Anyway, so it's looking more and more like this Bitcoin global standard of value sci-fi LARP is actually going to be a thing. And you are still early to get into it. And you should do so via DCA, and you should have fun, stay humble, and stack sats or satoshis is the common phrase in Bitcoin culture. Okay, do you want to ask questions, or should we get into the self-custody stuff?
I do want to get into self-custody. I just want to mention one thing that we were talking actually about at lunch yesterday with Nicole Shanahan. I mean, we were having a little side convo about how when you're getting into Bitcoin, I mean, we need to talk also about actually self-custody. I'm kind of forgetting. Oh, now I remember what it was. Okay. So how you kind of don't want your money to be multi-purpose. And that's kind of a big difference between Bitcoin. And like, I remember a podcast I saw between Jack Mahlers and Peter Schiff, who's like a gold bug. He's like all about the gold standard. And maybe you can actually mention like when the gold standard fell out, if you know anything about that, and like how it's related to.
That's a Jack thing.
Maybe it'll come walking through some knowledge. Point. Okay. Well, so the American dollar is not on a gold standard anymore. I think it fell out in the 50s. So our money is just not really based in anything that's real and tangible and actually has value. We're just kind of printing it at this point. And it's, I mean, we all are seeing with the cost of living just going through the roof over the past few years, especially. But we were talking about how if you want to use gold as currency, you could use it as money, but you could also use it for other things. And then Bitcoin is different because Bitcoin is just money. That's what it is. Do you want to talk a little bit about why that's beneficial?
Bitcoin's total uselessness for anything other than being used as money is a feature, not a bug. And basically the reason why that is like you want money to be a very clean index of value of kind of everything in the world. Right, it's like you want it to kind of be like a share in the world. Kind of the role of money as an economic asset, separate from all other ones, I think of as it being the asset with the least amount of risk. And Bitcoin, I do believe, is the asset with the least amount of risk of any asset that exists today. Period. Which is funny because a lot of people think the exact opposite, but they're stupid. And so the moment that your asset is useful for other external uses, it's now subject to kind of weird, unpredictable volatilities. And unpredictability is always risk. That always adds risk. So, yes. The fact that Bitcoin is so freaking useless for anything other than being a money, and this is going completely against the narratives you're going to be hearing as you are getting into like shitcoin land, which, by the way, do not get into shitcoin land. If you don't understand how a blockchain works, which I'm betting none of you do, you do not have the ability to discern anything. You do not have the ability to evaluate any of the like propositions of any of these shitcoin projects. So just stay away. Just stick with Bitcoin. And again, the fact that it is so useless is actually a feature and makes it a far better money than any of these other projects that add, you know, applications or usefulness to these things.
Because money is ultimately supposed to be an abstraction of value.
It is.
That's all it's supposed to be.
Abstraction of value. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Self-custody.
Self-custody.
That's what the people
okay.
want.
How to start? Can you start small? You can start incredibly small. Like I said, Pam, the smallest unit of Bitcoin that you can purchase, that you can own, is a Satoshi. There is 100 million Satoshis per Bitcoin, which means at today's price, a Satoshi is just, excuse me, just under 1/10 of 1 penny. So, yes, you can start very small, Pam. The first stage is to get an account at an exchange, and an exchange is a service where you send fiat to the exchange and they send you Bitcoin. This is where, like, the means by which you can buy Bitcoin, and it depends what country you're in. Coinbase, I think, is generally the easiest and the one that's available in the most countries.
Cash App is pretty common too.
Cash App, the smaller, more convenient ones, Cash App in the States. In Canada, we have something called ShakePay. They're a little bit easier to use, but generally they're going to try to screw you on the fees. So I think Coinbase is probably the best to use, but you can use Cash App or ShakePay. If you're buying in high, like if you're buying in high amounts, you might want to look into other options. I know in Canada, the best one is, what is it, BTC Bull or something. But yeah, if you're buying in higher amounts, you might want to look into more like higher end exchanges. But for the most part, Coinbase, I think, is a great kind of shelling point to just start with. Make an account with Coinbase. I think you got to do some KYC. Yeah.
What's that mean?
KYC, know your customer. You'll have to give them your passport or something. I don't know. It's been a while since I've had to do this. It might have changed. But yeah, get an account with an exchange. Send fiat to the exchange and just start buying Bitcoin. As I said, I strongly recommend you buy small amounts over time. A lot of these exchanges, I believe Coinbase does this, where you can set up auto buys. So it will kind of automatically do the DCA for you. Define a high amount. High is relative. Let's say, a million or more, Lori. That's what I would say is a high amount. Where should we keep it long term? Yeah, I'm getting there, Paulina. So this is how you get Bitcoin. Is you get an account on exchange, you send fiat to the exchange, they will hold your hand through all of this, and there's all kinds of YouTube tutorials that you can find to help you do this. And then you will buy Bitcoin. Once you've bought the Bitcoin on the exchange, you do not really own it. There's a saying in Bitcoin called "not your keys, not your coins." And what that means is when you buy Bitcoin on an exchange and it says you now have XYZ amount of Bitcoin, what they're really saying is we have XYZ Bitcoin under your name. And you are trusting them that if you try to withdraw that Bitcoin, that they will send it to you. But it's like a bank in the sense that, you know, they might not send it to you. And the history of Bitcoin is littered with stories of exchanges that have either gotten hacked and all their coins were taken, of exchanges that were straight up scams that the people literally just stole all running them, just stole everyone's coins and fled to, you know, the Caribbean or some island somewhere and were never heard from again.
That's what an ETF is, right? An exchange, or is that different?
No, an ETF is something different. Okay. An ETF is it like a trad by economic instrument that you could purchase through if you have a tax advantage savings account. In Canada, they're TFSAs. I don't know, what are they called in the States?
I don't even know.
But yeah, ETFs might be worth looking into as a way to get exposure to Bitcoin without having taxes through your tax advantage account or whatever your government lets you not pay taxes on. But we're talking about self-custody here. ETFs are not self-custody because it's basically it's like buying, you know, a paper gold, right? It's like trading, you know, paper silver on the stock market. It's the same kind of thing, but with Bitcoin instead of silver or gold. So you've bought in some Bitcoin, you're on Coinbase, it says you own this much Bitcoin. You don't actually own that yet because they could, you know, the government might ask them, hey, this person tweeted the wrong thing, don't give it to them. They might shut down, you know, they might get hacked, whatever. So the best thing to do is to actually withdraw the Bitcoin from Coinbase to a wallet that you control. And once that happens, now you own your Bitcoin. Now, on the Bitcoin ledger, on the Bitcoin blockchain that however many 50,000 different computers are all running at exactly the same time in the world, there is going to be an account for you that says, you know, an identifier for you. This would be your public key. And then an amount, and that's how much Bitcoin you own. And now you really own it, and no one can take it from you. No one can inflate it. No one can prevent you from spending it for someone else ever.
That would be known as cold storage, right?
Not necessarily. So what you want to do is send the Bitcoin. And by the way, as you're doing this, you're going to want, there's going to be more information that you're probably going to want other than what I'm going to be able to provide you in whatever amount of time this conversation is going to take. So you are going to need a little bit of your own research. There are some awesome YouTube channels to help you with this. My favorite one is a fellow Canadian called BTC Sessions. Maybe you can add that to the show notes or something.
Yes.
BTC Sessions. He is awesome for like every little detail of using Bitcoin, from using exchanges to setting up different wallets. Everything you could imagine. He has like 2-hour YouTube videos where he really holds your hand and assumes you're a complete idiot and gets you from zero to where you need to go. So don't be afraid of that kind of thing, because you, especially as you're starting out, you are going to have to do a little bit of, it's going to take a little bit of mental effort on your part to wrap your head around this, because that's Bitcoin. There's no one doing it for you. It's you. You are the one doing it. So you do need to take some personal responsibility for this process. The whole point in Bitcoin is that you're not delegating the authority to do this kind of thing to anyone other than yourself. But anyway, so have your Bitcoin on Coinbase. You're going to withdraw it. You're going to withdraw it to a wallet. Once it's in a wallet, you really own it. Now, what is a wallet? A wallet is a device. It does two things. One is there's a few things. It stores your private keys, and your private keys are the thing by which you use to sign transactions, right? It's like writing a check. A Bitcoin transaction is a lot like a check. You have like, you know, who it's coming from, who it's going to, what the amount is, and a signature. That's basically a Bitcoin transaction. Your private key is a little secret mathematical object that you use to sign the transactions. If anyone learns about your private key, they basically own your Bitcoin. Not basically, they do. So like that private key kind of is your Bitcoin, because that's what you use to spend it. If you know that, you can do whatever you want with the money. So a wallet stores your private keys, ideally without letting anyone else know what they are. It, using your private key, looks at the Bitcoin blockchain and figures out what Bitcoin you own, and kind of indexes that. So it's storing all of your UTXOs, all of your Bitcoin bills that it can see, okay, he owns this one, he owns this one, he owns this one. Here's all my bills. And then the third thing it does is that signs transactions. It creates and signs transactions using your private key. So that's what a wallet does. There are kind of two types of wallets. There's hot wallets and cold wallets. A hot wallet is any wallet, and ultimately these are just programs on like some kind of computer. A hot wallet is any wallet that is on a device that has ever or ever will be connected to the internet. A cold wallet is any wallet that is on a device that has never, will never, and ideally can never be connected to the internet. So what is the reason for this distinction? Well, malware is essentially the reason for this distinction. There is all kinds of malware out there that you can download without knowing it. And this is what the malware does. It sits on your computer and it does nothing. You don't even know it's there. And all this malware does is it just looks around your computer and tries to find something that looks like a Bitcoin private key. And if it finds it, it phones home and says, hey, I found a Bitcoin private key. And then the person that wrote the malware now owns your coins. Right? So you really don't want that to happen. So hot wallets are inherently more dangerous than cold wallets because there is always the possibility for some kind of malware to be stealing your private keys. So an example of a hot wallet would be, you know, if you download any wallet on your iPhone, any wallet on your iPhone is a hot wallet. Any wallet you download on your computer that doesn't require some external device to use is a hot wallet. There's nothing, I use hot wallets, like when you get more advanced into Bitcoin, you'll probably start looking into Lightning, which is a way of very cheaply sending small amounts of Bitcoin. Like we're going to a farmer's market on Sunday, and that's what we'll be using. Lightning are hot wallets, and that's fine because you're using small amounts. And that's we think that that's a, when you're dealing with small amounts, basically it's not that big of a concern. It's like walking around with, you know, $500 in your pocket or something. Yes, someone might jack you and you're out $500. And so there's nothing wrong with having hot wallets, and I use hot wallets all the time. I'm just careful to not keep too much in them. Cold wallets, or wallets that have never, will never, and ideally can never be connected to the internet. This is where you want to store like large amounts of Bitcoin. Okay. And, you can kind of make your own cold wallet by just buying a computer that has never been connected to the internet and just kind of using it as a cold wallet. That's not generally recommended because, you know, the CIA has installed all kinds of weird, funky stuff into all computers and you can't really trust them. So generally the best thing to do is to buy what most people will call a cold wallet. Ledger is the most popular one. I do not recommend that one anymore. Trezor is another very popular one. The one that's the most recommended for Bitcoin is another, once again, a fellow Canadian company called Coldcard. And the creme de la creme of Coldcard is something called the Coldcard Q. It's a little expensive. I think right now with the Black Friday sale, it's $175. They make a much cheaper one, but it's a little bit more finicky to use. But my recommendation for a cold wallet for storing large amounts of Bitcoin is the Cold Card. And you can look that up. And BTC Sessions has hours of video content of taking you from complete idiot to pretty knowledgeable of how to use this thing. He will hold your hand through how to use it. And all you need to do is watch his videos and you'll be able to get there.
Chime in a sec.
You go ahead.
Okay.
I've been ranting.
No, this is all incredible. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding it because I'm somewhat of a noob. So I think maybe I'll ask good questions that other people might be curious about too. So in my perspective at this point, the benefit of a hot wallet is easier to like liquidify the asset to pay for stuff.
Easy access, convenience.
Yes. So if you know
like
you're
a checking account.
Right. So if you're, it's like a checking versus a savings, essentially.
Yes.
So the benefit of having a hot wallet with some small amount of Bitcoin in it is if you're going to be somewhere that you can spend Bitcoin and you want to spend Bitcoin, then you would use a hot wallet versus long-term storage would be the cold wallets because that's what's going to be the most safe.
Yeah. Long-term storage is like, you know, a vault filled with gold that you've buried 20 feet under the ground. You don't want to use that to dig into that every time you want to pay for your groceries.
Okay. Second question is when we've been using Bitcoin for, let's say, the past like 6 years, we use Electrum wallet and it's on like a USB drive. Would that be considered cold storage?
It depends how you use it. So what you can do is you can buy a computer that has never been connected to the internet. You can get a copy of the Electrum software on a USB stick, plug it in to this un-internet connected laptop, let's say, install it, set up a seed phrase on this thing, and then using a second instance of Electrum on a
on a device that is connected to the internet, you can like construct the transaction here, sign it on the cold laptop, and then using the USB stick, carry it over to the hot side and use the hot side to then broadcast to the network. So you can do it that way, but it's kind of a pain in the ass. This is kind of what these cold wallets do. Is there like a little mini computer that they're serving the role of this whole separate laptop. And rather than having to use this, you just use a laptop or whatever computer, you can your phone often, whatever your internet connected device is, and this little like cold wallet, and that's all you need. The two kind of talk to each other.
Say what that one that you recommend,
cold card.
I'll put it in a Telegram.
Cold card Q is the best one, but they make a cheaper one. I can't remember what it's called.
Okay.
I think it's just called the Cold Card Mark IV or something.
Okay.
Hot, bad, cold, good for noobs. Hot isn't bad. It's just bad for storing large amounts of Bitcoin, Lori. Hot is good if you want to like go out and actually like spend Bitcoin on things like your groceries. Yes. Rachel says, is Bitcoin like fiat money where it's good to diversify where we keep holdings? That's a difficult question for me to answer. Bitcoin is so undervalued at this point that the easiest answer to that question is like the dumber and the more all in you get on Bitcoin, probably in the long run, the better off you're going to be. The issue is that the Bitcoin cult might be wrong. There is a non-zero possibility that we're wrong. With every year that goes by, it's getting less and less likely that we're wrong, but it's never impossible. The other thing is Bitcoin is quite volatile, and depending on what your current situation is, you might not be able to handle a certain amount of volatility, right? If you can't handle your net worth going down 50%, then you should only allocate a percentage of your portfolio that Bitcoin going down. Hola.
Hola.
If you can only you should only allocate a certain percentage of your portfolio that you would be okay going down, 50%. So yeah, it's hard to really to really answer that question generally, Rachel, but I hope that was somewhat helpful.
I mean, one other thing that maybe I'll add is like, if you're following Bitcoin on Cash App, it's been like hitting all-time highs recently. And so if you look at, I mean, maybe like it's really bullish, but maybe it goes down 3% one day or over a couple days. But then if you look at the year time scale, it's up over 150%. So like the longer of a game you're playing, the more you're going to get out of it, basically. So if you have expendable cash that you can put into Bitcoin, I mean, that's at least what I've been doing, is just doing that.
Yes. And your Bitcoin investment, don't try to get cute and time and swing trade. Like, oh, it's up, I'm going to sell, and then I'm going to wait for it to go back down, and I'm going to buy more, and now I have more Bitcoin. Do not try to do that. I guarantee you are too stupid to make that work, and you will just end up with less Bitcoin than you started with if you just hold like an idiot, right? Bitcoin is for idiots. That is a feature, not a bug. You buy Bitcoin, spread it over time, and you stop thinking about it. You should not be buying Bitcoin. Like, when you buy Bitcoin, you should be assuming that I'm going to hold this for 10 years, right? This is not like, oh, I'm going to do some kind of cute, like, swing tradey thing. I'll buy up this month and sell. Do not do that. Okay. I think, and, this might not hold true for everyone, but the reason why I like Bitcoin so much is that when you learn how to adopt the Bitcoin standard and it is like a lifestyle and it's like a mental thing, you stop worrying about finances, you stop getting stressed about finances, you're just life, and your mind just can think about other things all the time, and it's wonderful. And every now and then you look at your finances like, oh, that's nice. Rachel says, I'm implying more of the concept of multiple. Oh, I see. So Rachel just said, should we have more than one wallet to like spread it out? That's a good question, Rachel. And the best answer to that is, you would need to have an awfully lot of Bitcoin to start thinking about that kind of thing, right? So like not keeping, you know, having one wallet here, one wallet there. By the way, like the thing that the way that these cold wallets work is you have like a seed phrase, right? And these seed phrases are like, that's like your password. That basically is your private key. That's the thing that your cold wallet uses to generate your private key that you use to sign transactions. And so this seed phrase is like, you have to remember that. You know, a lot of people, they'll stamp it into steel plates and then bury it in their yard or something like that. Or, you know, they do all kinds of crazy stuff. You know, put it in these fireproof boxes, you know, like split it up and like, you know, encode it using different book passages and split it up in three different places, like all around the world. I know plenty of Bitcoiners that if they want to gain access to their seed phrase, they need to like visit two other places in the world. Like it takes them like a week to collect it all because they've separated out like over the globe to make it harder to get to. So Rachel, the answer is yes, eventually. That is not something a noob should be thinking about though. You know, when you get to, you know, $1 billion worth of Bitcoin, you can start thinking about like geo-separated multi-sigs and all this crazy stuff. Swing trading can make US taxes complicated. Yes, it can. So having cold wallet in Canada and in El Salvador is better than traveling with you. Yes, absolutely. Carly, you never, your seed phrase, do not travel with it. That, again, think of your seed phrase and your cold wallets as a safe with a bunch of gold bars. It's buried 20 feet under the ground. The nice thing about Bitcoin is you can send coins to your vault buried 20 feet under the ground. But you do need to dig up the vault. You can send coins to your vault buried 20 feet under the ground without having to dig it up. You only need to dig up the vault when you want to take them out. Right. So yes, you do not want to travel. I never travel with my cold wallets. Yes, absolutely not. Are there any more questions that I missed?
I have something maybe okay. To add. So, I mean, if people have high yield savings accounts, they're typically over like be like 5% or less APY, and like that's just nothing compared to Bitcoin, right? So it just makes a ton of sense if you're going to do savings. And I think yesterday Jack was even giving some people some thoughts around like if you have retirement funds, you're going to make way more money on them if you put them into Bitcoin.
Yes, and that's where the ETFs can be valuable to use, even though they're not real Bitcoin, not your keys, not your coins. They can get taken from you if you have, and I don't know what the name in the States is, but in Canada we have these things called tax-free savings accounts, and it's like this special investment account that the government lets you have, and all investments you make through this account you don't pay any taxes on. So obviously, the bank isn't going to let you hold, at least no bank that I'm aware of is going to let you self-custody Bitcoin through this account. But they generally will let you purchase Bitcoin ETFs. And Bitcoin ETFs, if they're structured properly, like GBTC, I think is the most popular one, will follow the price of Bitcoin pretty exactly. And you can also do things like MSTR, which is a little bit more leverage and risky play. But yeah, so generally these tax advantage accounts, they're very Roth IRA. Yeah, that sounds right. Generally, these tax advantage accounts put a very heavy limit on how much you can put into them. And so, you know, if you really are trying to get all in on Bitcoin, maxing out whatever that is on, you know, Bitcoin, Bitcoin ETFs or Bitcoin companies, in addition to the self-custody Bitcoin, I think is actually a good idea. Is there any way to stake BTC that can be trustworthy? It depends what you mean by trustworthy, Rachel. You can obviously loan Bitcoin. There are services that let you do this, but you're adding risk, right? Like whenever you're loaning these Bitcoin, you're giving it to someone else and they might not pay you back. So that's risky. A less risky way would be running something called a Lightning channel, and this is a way of you acting as a service provider to the Lightning network to allow this second layer of Bitcoin called Lightning, which allows you to send very small transactions very cheaply. You can act as a liquidity provider to the Lightning network, and you can make small fees. I don't actually know. I've never actually seriously done that. So I don't know what the percentages are. I believe they're pretty low. But that's something you could look into. That's very advanced, though. And I'm not saying like never get there, but
when you're a noob, I would, you know, not think about that to start with. But that's something you might be interested in. And BTC Sessions, I know, has plenty of videos on, you know, figuring out how to use the Lightning Network and even how to be an LSP, a Lightning Services provider. So that is the most trustworthy way of generating yield on Bitcoin that I am aware of.
Cool.
Do you have any U.S. unretired friends who successfully moved a portion of 401k funds or Roth IRA funds into Bitcoin? I'm sure that I do know them. I don't know. Like, I'm sure that I know that I know people that have done that, even though, you know, I couldn't say who they were. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Jack has some thoughts on that. So maybe I'll ask him after this, and I can leave some voice notes in the Telegram as well. I mean, maybe one important point to make as like the link between decentralization and health and finance is like, I mean, the perfect example, is it Jack?
I don't
Jack
know.
Who? Oh, no. Is COVID, because essentially what happened in COVID is if you felt uncomfortable about taking jabs, but you couldn't financially afford to leave your job and say like, screw you, like I'm not taking it, then you basically had to sacrifice your health for money. So you're basically sacrificing time for money. And so being able to give yourself financial sovereignty in a way that's durable over the long term allows you to stand up for yourself essentially and prioritize your health and the health of your family and not silence or censor yourself as well. Any thoughts on that?
No, I think, yeah, it's heartening to see the kind of shift in politics in the States right now, but you never know when it might go the other way. Yeah, if you own Bitcoin, you know that no matter what happens in the world, you're not going to get debanked. It's one less thing to worry about.
Yep. And I guess for people, you kind of alluded to it earlier, but for people who don't know, there's a Bitcoin standard here in El Salvador, so it's legal tender here. And there are a couple other countries that are considering doing that as far as I know as well. I think Jack said Suriname.
A lot of, yeah, Argentina is looking to do it. I mean, Trump has made noises about at least partially backing USD with Bitcoin, which would be kind of crazy. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think if there's anything else you want to cover about Bitcoin, let me know. But plug also your business and what you're working on a little bit.
Oh, I work at a project called Zorp, Z-O-R-P. And we are working on a bunch of very fancy cryptographic technologies vaguely related to Bitcoin type stuff. It's very, very difficult to explain what we're doing. It's basically magic. It's computers that can magically prove exactly what they're doing, and while keeping all of your private information private. The most immediate interest to this crowd is probably that Jack Cruz is very interested in our technology, and in particular using it for this new decentralized medical science thing that I don't know how much of this he's talked publicly about. But so I won't go too much more into that, but stay tuned. Interesting things are happening.
Awesome. Does anybody have any last minute questions? Otherwise we'll sign off, and I'll get a bunch of links in the Telegram. I'm also going to put this on my podcast, so in the show notes there will be links to the cold storage he was talking about and the Bitcoin sessions and any other resources he thinks will be valuable. I'll put them in there so that we can access them moving forward. And you're just, gosh, such a wealth of knowledge. So glad we were able to connect on this trip.
Mm-hmm. It's been fun.
Yeah, it's very fun. All right. Thank you all.
Thanks, folks. Hope this was helpful. Nice to meet all of you.
Likewise.
Stay humble, stack stats.
What he said.
All right.
Bye.